Hello, my name is Dr. Vanessa Kimball, and I am a baker. But I'm also someone who has studied and researched the impact of bread on our health for many years. I run the Sourdough School in Northamptonshire, and my specialism is bread and the gut microbiome and the impact on our mental health. But I'm also trained as a nutrigenetic practitioner, meaning I look at the way that bread impacts people according to their genetics. It helps me to personalise bread. And in this podcast, I'm going to be chatting to someone who I hope you are going to find as interesting as I did. What I'd love is for you to listen and think about the bread that you bake, eat, and share with your family. Because bread is a staple, it's our most basic food, and I believe it is the foundation to good health.
My name is William Rubel, R-U-B-E-L.
Yeah, carry on.
And I do many things. I publish a children's magazine called Stone Soup.
Yeah.
It's a magazine of writing and art by children that I started when I was 19. So that's about 130 years ago. And I write about culinary history. Bread is one focus, but I also write about early modern kitchen gardens. I write about traditional foodways in general, which includes hearth cooking or making alcohol at home. I write about wild mushrooms, particularly Amanita muscaria, the iconic mushroom with the red cap and white dots. It's edible if parboiled. And its bad rap is its own story.
We've been chatting across the pond for several years now.
I think so, yes. We're Facebook friends, yes. from a Facebook bread history group.
How cool is that? Just to come out and go, hey, let's actually meet. Your Facebook bread history group has amassed. I remember when you first started, it was just like a handful of people. And how many members are there now?
It is 2,000 members now.
It's really galloped along recently, hasn't it?
It has grown very steadily from the beginning.
I think about
2 years ago, Christmas.
Sorry, can you say it again? I started it.
I started it about 2 years ago, Christmas. So this is 2016, I think around December 2014, with 60 friends from my own Facebook friend group. And it really has grown very steadily.
Now, the thing that drew me to you was this lovely little book. And if I'm truthful, it sat for a long time, and I dip in and out of it next to my bed.
Well, I'm honored that it has such a place. Of course, who doesn't buy a book? And I have so many books I've never opened, so I'm grateful you've dipped into it.
Yeah, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It's one that sometimes I clear the books away from the side of the bed because I can't be bothered, but this one has stayed. And every time I've sort of had an hour, I've just kind of dipped in and read bits of it. I didn't read it all in one go, and I haven't read it all page to cover to cover. I kind of open it and just dip in.
Well, I think it's how most of us read now. And this is a small book, so actually it could be read at one sitting. It's Bread, A Global History in the Reaction Books food series. But it certainly is designed to be dipped into rather than to be read from start to finish.
So I have some very specific questions to ask you, and I'm going to start with a little bit, very quickly. How did this book come about?
And how long did it take to write?
The editor of Reaction Books, Michael Lehman, goes to the Oxford Symposium on Food and Cooking to sell books and also to look for authors. So I'm a regular at that conference in every July in Oxford. So he approached me about writing this book. I actually don't remember why he approached me for this book.
Is that why you met John Letts and made friends with John?
No, I've known John. John's never been to the Oxford Symposium, and I've known John Letts from, not from the conference.
He lives down the road, I assumed.
No, I don't remember how I found out about him, but I made contact with him. I think even before he started growing wheat.
Right, so you've known him for 25 years? 30?
I am very bad about dates. I was trying to think about that the other day. In relation to John.
Yeah.
I don't know, more like probably 15 years.
Okay. It's the chaps who are editing this both have met John and interviewed him, particularly Rich Ward.
I helped him. I helped him harvest his first commercial harvest. It was really wonderful. There was more grain than he'd expected, so we had to run out to a building supply shop to get those giant plastic sacks that can hold a ton of grain each.
What happy memories. So, I have some specific questions that I want to ask you. I would like to know from someone who... How long did this book take you to research? A long time. Because then I can see this from the depth to which you've gone in. How long did it take you?
I started baking bread when I was 11.
Okay.
And that's when I fell in love with baking. And I found... I never throw anything away, which is its own personal problem. I found some years ago something I had written when I was 20, and it was about yeast, and it clearly was written to be read. It wasn't for myself. It already was sort of teaching and exploring yeast more deeply than just open a packet of yeast. I wrote a book called The Magic of Fire, which is a book on hearth cooking. It was published in 2002. I'd always wanted to write about bread. That book was very well received, so immediately it became possible for me to publish on sort of any food subject I was interested in. So I started writing this. I started writing about bread in 2002. This little book, and I call it a little book. This is physically a small book. It's only 30,000 words. And... So I wrote this, you know, when I don't remember. I'm very bad with dates. You know,
yeah,
I wrote this for Michael.
It was
published in 2011. I'm a very, very slow writer, so this took me 2 or 3 years to write. I know a friend who also has written for this series, whose name I won't repeat. He said, "Well, William, you should do this if you can write it in 2 months. If it will take you more than 2 months, then don't, because of course." The pay is rather poor. It took me at least 3 years to write it. But it's a synthesis of a lot of research I'd already done. I have, by the time I started this, I had about maybe 5 meters of notebooks in a bookshelf. This is all internet research that's been printed out. So yes, it's well researched, but it's sort of a new thinking about bread. I think my approach is that bread is a cultural object. You know, bread is not something harvested by a farmer. There is a breadfruit, but there is no bread that gets picked from a tree. Farmers don't grow bread; they grow grain. And whatever the bread is like that you buy. Every decision about that bread was a cultural decision. Which grain to use, how refined the flour was going to be, whether it's an unleavened bread, leavened, whether if leavened it's a disc like a pita bread, or whether it is a cracker like a matzah or a lavash. If it's a loaf bread, does it have a soft crust? Does it have a tight crumb? Does it have an open crumb? Is it chewy? Everything about this is an invention of culture and a reflection of culture. So this is my approach to bread, that bread is an invention, no, just as the chair is, just as the recorder that you're using, just as this bicycle that you've just been riding, or the car that I drove up. We're in San Francisco, so I drove up from my home in Santa Cruz to San Francisco for this interview. So that's sort of the focus, or the general approach, I should say, the rubric that holds the my research together. But yes, it's very well researched. And I'm now writing, actually I'm under contract with University of California Press for a much larger history of bread.
Oh, that sounds like something.
I think of this one as the sort of the introduction. For me, this was...
You're as obsessed as the other people that I know. Everyone has their passion, and it's just a real honour to be sitting here with you. And your eyes are absolutely lit up as you talk about it. It's just wonderful. So, talking about cultural, San Francisco sourdough. We've sat in Tartine. We met in Tartine. William, can you give me your opinion or your research from your knowledge of where the phenomenon of sourdough has come from?
Let's back up, if that's all right. Okay. You say we're in San Francisco, and San Francisco is identified with sourdough. But for most of my life, it was identified with the sourdough from a bakery called Boudin Bakery. And for us, it was the tourist bread. It was not the bread that you buy in a bakery shop. It's, and I have a lot of respect for Boudin. So I'm an historian, so I have no opinion on whether a bread is good or bad. Boudin is a very sour tasting sourdough bread. They definitely have kept a tradition that apparently started in the mid 19th century and is linked back with French and actually French bakers. So in that sense, the Boudin sourdough and the San Francisco sourdough tradition is consistent with the revival in the US, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, and the whole Anglophone world, where we have been inspired by the bakeries in Paris and, of course, particularly by Poilin, in as part of our reevaluation of food in the Anglophone world. It used to be when I went to England, I'm 64 this summer. I've been going at least once a year since I was 18, and the food wasn't very good, and it has been transformed, as food has been in the United States. And part of this revolution in food has been a change, a reevaluation of the bread of our mothers and fathers.
I want to challenge something there. As you probably know, I also collect a lot of history, and I've read a lot that indicates that bread didn't always taste great. So do you think we've got this romantic kind of view that old bread was delicious bread? Because if you read what people write about it, some of the descriptions are indicate that some of it was revolting.
Well, I'd be really interested in those descriptions, if not on the interview afterwards.
I have several bread books, and one in particular is The Book of Bread. I think, from memory, was written late 1800s, maybe very early 1900s.
1906.
1906, right, okay. So, yeah. And if you go to the back of there, he travelled the UK, and he just described the bread in most uncompromising terms: miserable cottage loaves, heavy, dark, sullen looking, sad, underproved, sour loaves. And this was the man found 200 different ways of describing bread that just tasted revolting. And actually, when I read it, I laugh, because it's really put into context just how poor the bread was. I mean, there are a few that he just sings about, like, you know, he waxes lyrical. The majority, he does it region by region, bakery by bakery. I don't know if you've seen...
Well, actually, I actually own the book.
Yeah.
And actually, this is a very important bread book in the history of...
There's only 200 of them, of that book. So you've got one of those as well. Or one of the original, the Book of Bread.
Right, I was going to talk about the prints.
Yeah, so you've seen the lithographic.
Well, isn't that there's interesting lithographs. Yeah. There's sort of printing experiments, but there also are silver prints. There's actually photographs in the book.
Yeah.
And what's quite extraordinary is that, and I will say, he's the inspiration for I'm going to be illustrating my bread history that I'm writing. He illustrates breads with the life-size cross-sections. And I think that it's completely insane, and I'm an opinionated person, stupid, to illustrate your bread book with a picture of the outside of a loaf, because the outside of the loaf tells you almost nothing about the bread. I mean, you can have that picture, comma, too. But what really is important is, and informative, is the crumb structure. So the Book of Bread is an innovative work in terms of bread illustration. But then, writing as an historian, we have to ask is, well, what is his opinion? I mean, who is he? What is his taste? Where does he come from? So Vanessa, you're talking about sourdough and sour breads being wonderful. In his opinion, sour is a negative. He speaks about heavy being bad, and I could talk about heavy literally for an hour. I mean, not joking. Heavy was definitely a very negative term that came in the late 18th century. And heavy breads are breads, classically, that feel heavy for their size. And that was considered, so in other words, if you have half a kilo of dough, say with lots of yeast in it, it's going to puff up. Now, if you have a bread that's that same size as that puffed up, but it's not puffed up on the inside, then that bread is going to feel heavy. Because we have a very clear idea in our heads about what the weight should be for volume of bread.
Yeah, and also, sorry, I was going to cough then. Also, from my point of view as a baker, a heavy loaf is an underproved loaf. It hasn't developed its yeast. It hasn't had time or the right sort of temperature. So it would indicate that it's, for me, that is not a good loaf. A heavy loaf for me is, as I would agree with this man who wrote in 1906.
That's right. I mean, certainly.
What's his name? Owens? No.
Yeah, I get aphasia for names, so let's just look it up.
The bread book is...
It's Owen.
How many of them are there? There's 206 of them, isn't there? It's something really a very, very small number. I feel like we're related now.
Do you have a copy?
Yes. Absolutely.
How good is your copy?
It's pretty damn good, actually. It's not. It's got a little chewy on the corners, but it's got all the prints in there. I use mine, so I don't want perfect.
I've never baked from it.
I do rake from mine. It's what got me into. It's just what got me to John Letts was baking from these amazing books.
Yes, Owen Simmons.
Owen Simmons. Oh, yeah. Oh, you see, I'm not so far off.
No. I get a fascia for names. So anyway, yes, Owen Simmons, The Book of Bread.
Yeah. So who was Owen? He was what? Just a baker at the time who had a passion for photography, a bit like me, really.
Yeah, this thing is very, very well produced, so it must have been, he's certainly well financed.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what the purpose of it was.
It's for bakers.
Yeah, but it was just, there was only 200 of them there, it's a very small print run.
That's true. That's a good question, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, relatively to, it almost is like a pet project.
Like vanity presses, we say.
Yeah. Oh, They retail for a lot of money nowadays. One of them, don't tell my husband, one of them recently sold for just under 6,000, I think.
Pounds.
Yeah. 5,000 something.
The prices are all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just depends on availability, doesn't it? If there's only one of them and the condition.
There's usually one up. There's usually one on the market. Yeah. It's rare, but it's not hugely rare. I think that's... There's the photographs needed to be in really mint condition. It's purchased for the photographs. That's why people buy the book. That's why it's valuable, is the photographs, not the book.
Right. Interesting. I personally found. I've got an Eliza Acton. I've got what's the other one? The one before Eliza. I can look at my bookshelf. I go back to my original. My earliest stuff is from about 1530s. So, not as obsessively collecting anymore, mainly because I'm building a school.
So you're broke.
Yeah. If I sold my collection, I could pay for the school without batting an eyelid. But
that's right.
I haven't actually.
Collectors always say, "Well, I'm not so actively collecting now."
No. Yeah.
Subvoce, I'm broke. Right.
I suppose I could, if I needed to, I could sell some of them, but it would be like selling old friends. And I think that the collection adds to what I teach, because I will chat and then reach for a book. Sometimes to show a recipe or a point that I want to make. So going back to bread not tasting great, we're all romanticising about this. Sorry, wait till that goes back. We're all romanticising about this really old-fashioned, delicious tasting, when bread tasted good. I think my question was, is that just kind of, excuse my language, is that nostalgic, wax lyrical bullshit? is it as simple as that?
What's hard for me is I don't know what people think. To be honest.
But historically, what were people saying?
Historically, what are people saying? Ask that another way.
Okay. If we were to eat the bread that was being produced now, would we think it was that delicious?
Well, I don't believe there's been any change in the way bread has been made or the recipes. Well, first of all, there is no such thing as bread now. So there's bread that... Look, let's take the bread from Tartine.
Yeah.
So we're looking at a loaf that you bought some days ago. But this is, and it's cut open, and we can see this beautiful, to us, open crumb, very dark, crusty on the top. This is a French style bread. It's been what we currently associate with a French style bread. It's not been baked in a tin. This one is extremely crudely formed, so that we can see, for example, if we turn upside down, there's a fold in the bottom, so you can see two halves have been pulled together, but not an effort has not been made to make the bottom smooth. I only have one end of the oval, and it doesn't come to an even end. It's crude. It's a little. There's a V.
It's quite funny, because that crudeness takes a huge amount of skill to produce.
Well, it may, and that's an aesthetic, and it's a statement about this is a court bread. If we separate out just conceptually cooking, there's home cooking, the cooking that women make, the bread that women make at home, and then there's bread for the, there's food for the court, for the high status table. So yes, this is a bread for the high status table, and it's been crafted to appear to be a peasant bread, made by somebody that's in a big hurry, that has no particular craft skill. They can make bread. But the difference between a home baker and a professional baker is massive. If you consider Parmentier, for example.
Oh, sorry, can you say that again? Because I've just got a clunk on the recording. It's all right.
If you consider the difference between a home baker and a professional baker, it's immense. So we can take an author like Parmentier, the last quarter of the 19th century. He's the Frenchman who is most associated with having introduced the potato to France. But in fact, he wrote a lot about bread and was very interested in bread. He has a book for bakers, for the boulanger, but he also had a book that he wrote in 1777 for the home baker, for the housewife. And in the past, there was this clear distinction between the home baker and the professional baker. And if you think about it, even then, if you're baking bread at home, let's say you did a fortnightly baking, so you bake 24 times a year, times 10 years, you've made 240 batches, right? There's 12 months in the year. Every 2 weeks, you've baked bread 240 times in 10 years. You take a professional baker, even if they only have one batch a day, then that is, 3,500 in 10 years. But in fact, bakers have multiple batches in a day. You fire up that wood-fired oven in the 18th century, your commercial bakery, you're going to bake 2, 3, 4 batches in a day. And then imagine the volume difference. The household has made, 100 kilos of bread, the professional baker. We're talking just apples and oranges in terms of technique. And so here we have in a court baker in the United States, in San Francisco, that never had a peasantry. America never had a peasantry. People came here to not be peasants, and we never established, there was never a peasant class here. Making a bread that emulates a bread from some farmhouse in France. Then again, we're emulating a farmhouse in France, not one in Germany, not one in Italy, not one in Sweden. I've slightly lost my train
of thought. No, I'm absolutely loving this. This is really relevant.
Okay, my train of thought.
No, the train of thought's brilliant. It's fantastically fascinating. I mean, this to me, you see, I grew up with this. I was explaining to you earlier that I grew up from age 9 in southwest France.
But Vanessa, when you see that end there, I don't believe your baker would ever have put out a loaf of bread with that apparently crudely made end.
No, I would have shot for that.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, the French niche is round and tuckled. But that, I mean, that's, you're right. The culturally, that has been made to look.
But that's what makes it exciting. Your French niche is made by a baker who started at age 14. Who never graduated from high school and has gone through this extreme apprenticeship and can make a bread the same every single day, and it's perfect within that craft, particular craft tradition. So to me, this is completely different. It's also within a craft tradition, but it's actually not emulating your 14-year-old apprentice grown up into a baker.
It's been made to look even more rustic.
That's right, and it is the highest status bread right now in San Francisco, perhaps in the United States, and perhaps in the Anglophone world. So I'm an historian, so for me, that's great. And you have to say, well, why? Why do we rich people want a peasant-looking bread?
I think because... Well, there's a few reasons for me. It tastes great. I mean, you know, there's no question for me that is the most delicious bread. The texture, the flavour, that very dark crust has got this Maillard reaction with the sugars. So there's complexity in flavour. The texture, that custardy texture when it comes out of the oven and the way it kind of sits and kind of matures into this wonderful light tang. And I guess for me, it's texture, flavour and digestibility. That is massively important because as a person, individually, I turned back to long, slow fermentation and bread that had acidity to it purely for the fact that I was struggling to digest. So there's also kind of health issues around sourdough as well as there's more than one element.
Okay, I have a hard time keeping track. Short-term memory issues, but let me try to keep track. So first, let me try to keep track of all these. First of all, everything you said is massively culturally charged. And whenever I give talks about bread, I always start with the same line. So I ask my audience, and I can ask you here and those listening, to close your eyes and imagine the night sky. If you're in a big city like London and there is no night sky, just imagine being in a countryside, clear night where you can see the Milky Way.
Oh yeah, I know exactly where I am. So I'm in the village in France. The lights have just gone out. They go out at 11. I'm lying on my back in a field and I can see the Milky Way all the way across and there's crickets. I can hear the crickets. So I know exactly where I am.
Okay, Vanessa. Now, when you, in your mind's eye, look up at your French Milky Way.
It's beautiful, yes.
Nowhere in those stars is the recipe written for the best bread or even good bread. There is no recipe in those stars. All of these ideas are cultural. And well, I'll get to them. You've got a beautiful crust. Well, until recently, nobody in our social class would have eaten that beautiful crust. It was baked dark to rasp it off. It was considered indigestible in the medical system, the Galenic system, which is the system prior to the germ theory of disease, really, but began to shift as modern science developed at the end of the 1600s. But even in the 19th, even in the 18th century, and even in 19th century cookbooks, they shaved off the crust, both in the UK and in the United States. So that crust that you perceive as being beautiful, that's the people of today feeling it's beautiful. People in the past felt that we couldn't eat that crust, that you and I, now a laborer, could eat that crust, because our social class felt that laborers were sort of physiologically different. It was a different kind of racism. But I had asked you, you didn't listen to what I asked you. I know you're the interviewer and I'm being the controlling person. I asked you about the shape of the bread and you responded with its flavor. So I asked you why we want this extremely crude shape. What makes that appealing today? Because it could have been, let's say, more consistently molded, more And of course, to a craft baker in France, more correctly and properly formed. I mean, you look at this bread, it would be rejected as a failed bread in a bread school in France.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the way it's formed, for that irregularity on the end. I mean, it's bien cuit, which is a style in a French bakery. You can ask for the breads, especially baguettes that are dark versus ones that are light for those who prefer that taste. But, you know, why, and I think it's a good question, you know, why in this age, I'm holding up, you can't see this, you can't see this because it's a radio interview, but I'm holding up my really beautiful iPhone. And I've been buying Apple products since the very beginning. I'm taking my iPhone out of the case. It is one flaw in the system that, you know, for someone like me who drops it all the time, I can't have it in its beautiful form. But I've taken it out, and this is just a lovely object. And this object does have some people involved in assembling it, but this is made by robots. And this is just a magnificent piece of industrial craft. And it is the opposite. If, Vanessa, you can hand me this bread. We can have them together. So in one hand, I have this like slightly burnt, completely crude, and apparently sloppy, even if it actually took lots of craft, bread. And next to it, I have this lovely iPhone. Now, we're in San Francisco, and I can assure you that we were just at Tartine Bakery, that there will be nary an Android user in that bakery, that, you know, everybody has these lovely, lovely iPhones. And at the same time, lusts after the lovely iPhone. I was online yesterday looking at, well, maybe do I want that? I want that new iPad that recently came out. Yes. But why do they want, on the one hand, this lovely industrial product, high craft, and on the other hand, want this apparently crude bread?
I think you hit the nail on the head. I think it's simply lust.
It's simply lust. And it's fashion. And it's fashion.
No, I think it's lust.
Yeah, lust.
You should meet the bakers.
Should meet the bakers. Okay.
There you go.
Now,
oh, no.
Do you want me to keep going,
Vanessa?
Are they
going to keep using? Are they going to use this bit? Oh, I hope that.
She's blushing. She's blushing. Her husband isn't listening.
Listen, there's going to be some packs to drop here. It's not just the bread.
So let's also take this bread that is just has massive holes in it, and I will say it's irregular from left to right. There are much bigger holes on the left side than there are on the right side, which one might say suggests some irregularity in the production. But I once spent some time at a cooking school in France, and I was there a day when I was not taking classes. I was looking at books in the library. And a baker had come in to teach class. And after it's over and the students have gone back to their hotel, or and actually it was a big place, they stayed there, it was on a chateau, we cut a bread in half, and actually this was Anne Willen's school, and Anne Willen cuts the bread in half and she looks at it, so Chateau de Fay, and she is very surprised at the big holes. And she says something about it, like, my goodness, you know, I'm sorry, I apologize, in a sense. Because she hadn't, it seemed, at that time, kept up with a change in how we want the crumb to look. So if you go back to 1970, 1960, a good French bread, would have had a more even crumb and smaller holes. So when you, Vanessa, were sort of lusting and waxing eloquent about the body of this bread, And I said, well, these are all culturally charged terms. So the fashion has changed. And this completely crude, giant holes, it's irregular. I mean, it's everything that's anti-craft. Because craft is about evenness, consistency. You know, it's simply remarkable. And it's fantastic. But, and I think that's why I'm interested in bread. And what I'm interested in, and what I've written about a little bit in this bread book of global history, and will be writing much more about in my book for UC Press, that's more like 700 pages, 100 and many thousand words, is that looking at the details of the loaf, that's where you start to get into nuance in culture. Now, I live in Santa Cruz, California, and that means I live where there are many Mexicans who live there who are farm workers, or they're the dishwashers. Of course, also the cooks in the restaurants here are all Mexican, whether or not the restaurant is Italian or French or pretty much anything else. Sometimes even Japanese. And when you go to their grocery stores, and we have Mexican markets, everybody speaks Spanish, it's a lot of products imported from Mexico, and the kinds of foods that these poor immigrants eat, the bread is soft, it's white. There's the American bread, Wonder Bread. It's actually owned now by the big Mexican conglomerate Bimbo, unfortunately named for those of us who are Anglophone. But Bimbo is the largest bakery company in the world. It's a multi-billion dollar company, expanding rapidly into China. I mean, there's no joke about Bimbo, and they own many very big and established bread companies in the United States. But these farm workers are eating this soft white bread, and yet on our table we are eating this French style bread that's not baked in a tin. And of course, when I grew up, I said I'm 64, we had tinned bread, beds baked in tins, though I am from a professional, not a super wealthy family, but, you know, a well-to-do family in Los Angeles. So we also did have hearth-baked breads from the bakery.
You're right. It's,
what's wrong with British bread? You know, it's
want to ask you something else.
Yeah.
Right. One of the things I mentioned to you about sourdough was this, the health aspect, digestibility and nutrition. Is it that the... I don't know how much you're sort of au fait with this, but we've stripped out all of the nutrients in the flour in the majority of British white bread, and then we have to add fortificants back in. And one of the other things, if on the other side you have wholemeal, then there's this phytic acid that strips out the minerals, making the micronutrients unavailable to us. So one of the key elements of wild or naturally leavened bread, sourdough, is this digestibility and the availability of nutrition. And I wondered, historically, you know, we're facing an epidemic of obesity at the same time as malnutrition. And culturally, we've taken this pappy white bread into our culture and accepted that that is what we eat. But when you question that, do you think perhaps that one of the appeals, because we just talked about the fact that, you know, personally I've got this connection, I have a physical, personal, very direct connection to this kind of bread because this is what I was brought up with and this is my childhood dream. But like you said, the rest of the world didn't live in southwest France. So is there something else going on here from history? Maybe it's maybe the educated classes have more understanding and knowledge.
Okay, first of all, I didn't agree. I've been letting you talk, which is polite. my silence doesn't mean that I agreed with everything that you said, and in fact, I don't agree with most of what you've just said. So, I'm not aware of any peer-reviewed studies that demonstrate that a sour leavened bread is any more nutritious or easier to digest than a yeasted bread.
There are studies talking about the phytic acid, that sourness, certainly with a whole grain, that sourness, the acidity in the bread, neutralizes the phytic acid. And that's from a medical side of digesting bread. That is a
good thing?
Well acknowledged, yeah, because it's the bioavailability of minerals. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's one of the areas that I teach.
Okay.
So that is probably, there are different elements coming into there, but it's certainly with whole grain bread.
Let me back. So I'd be interested in that.
Yeah,
because
okay. I simply don't know it.
Yeah. And I'm skeptical, I will just say.
It's a very well documented, very well researched of knowledge. If you Google phytic acid, you would see that that's just fact.
Okay. Then white bread is not new. Virtually nobody ate whole grain bread. I would say, ever. The largest brand, even for the cruder breads that were sold in the UK, where we have good data from the bread laws called the Assize for Bread, going back to 1400, a little bit earlier. But even if you go back to Roman breads, the larger bran was sifted out. Right now, people in the United States, whole wheat flour is defined as a flour that has up to 10% of the weight of the grain removed. So in other words, if you put 100 kilos through the mill, you can then, and you get this melange of flour, let's talk about stone ground flour, you've got this melange, so you're just going to mix it up, you've got this massive of everything of the grain, and you sift it, you could remove 10 kilos worth, so you'd have 90 kilos, and you could call that whole wheat flour. And I know most people, I'd say that to you, they, you read that with some cynicism, as if that was some new modern cheat. But it's not a modern cheat. This has been the definition of the flour, I'll say, from time immemorial. And you can work this out from milling records and from various other sources. So first of all, only the poorest of the poor would eat a 100% whole grain flour. Number two, we don't eat... standing back even a bit further, I think you have to ask the question, why is wheat the largest crop by acreage in the world? It's not fed to animals, by the way. It's not like corn. It's not like maize. Wheat is only eaten by people. Why wheat? Why not barley?
I'm guessing because of the gluten and because it makes a bread that is a pleasure to eat.
Because it makes white bread. And there is only one historic record with respect to white breads, which is It was the best bread. It was the beloved bread. And we have a written record in the literature, in Western literature, in other words, Greek, Latin, which is the white bread's the best. That said, there have been cultural critics all the way back 2,000 years who said, you know, only if people eat this, it's not good for you, and so forth. So, you know, both comments have gone side by side, just as we have the critics now. And in fact, you've been criticizing white bread just now. There's a very long tradition of that. But it is a that said, wheat and white bread has been important to us really forever, including as far back as the Neolithic period, because we have archaeobotanical evidence for white bread as well.
You were talking about that when we were a few months ago. You were talking about the fact that the sieving techniques disappeared because they were material. You were talking about cloths as sieving tools.
Yeah, I mean, sieves were made... So the way you make flour, before the current technology, which is called roller milling, using steel rollers that progressively reduce the grain to its constituent parts, the wheat, in other words, the bran, the germ, and various portions of the endosperm. Grain is about 15% bran, about 3% germ, and the rest of it is endosperm, from which white flour is derived. But the whitest flour is at the center, so you shouldn't imagine that there's this core that looks like a grain of white rice. That's not quite right. So there's various parts you can pull out. So up until the 19th century, that was done by grinding, whether you're grinding it on a flat stone like the Mexican matate, that the women grind the nixtamal to make their tortillas, or whether you're grinding it in a water mill or a windmill, you still, the principle was the same. You have a stone on the bottom that's more or less, and then you have a stone on the top that moves, and you reduce the grain to a powder. You then sift, and all you're doing is sifting out the larger pieces, that's the bran, and you sift out to the smallest pieces that will be the white flour. So you have those tools we cannot find from the past. You can only infer from photographs or literature.
Then that would have been cloths. You know, there's that.
I didn't say they would have been cloths. They would have just been, I mean, sieves can be made of many things. They're made of straw,
yeah.
Cloth, leather, yeah.
Cool. So just going back to the bread laws, I wanted to ask you...
Can we just finish?
Yeah, sorry.
Other strain?
Yeah.
We'll get to the bread laws. So, but the whole critique that I hear from many people is, you know, this nutrition thing. But, you know, we don't live on bread. Bread for us is a condiment. You know, how much bread per day are we eating? You know, we're not living on a kilo of bread or half a kilo per day. Bread is not where we get most of our calories. And I think that, and I've been trying to work this out this week, and I'm having a hard time, so I haven't gotten there yet. But I think if you like go in and you say, okay, what's the difference? If you've got 100 grams of whole grain, of that, 15 grams is the bran. By definition, it's all that's there. Well, what is the nutritional quality? A lot of that 15 grams is you know, we just pass through our stool, is fiber. So how much is the B12, the B vitamins and the calcium and the potassium and trace minerals in that 15 grams? Okay, what are we talking about? What milligrams? And, you know, might just eat, half a stalk of celery and call it quits, call it even. Or another way is when you mill, and I have a mill at home, a commercial mill, I mill all the time, and you realize, okay, well, I've got all this bran here, and I got all this flour here, and I do sift a white flour. Well, what I do is I add some sourdough, some sour starter or just leave out my bran. I add a little flour to make it stick. And then I bake it in a very low oven, and I make a bran cereal for myself. So yeah, I make white bread, and then I have the bran cereal for breakfast. So I just feel culturally what's interesting to me as an historian is why there is so much focus on the nutrition of something that is completely subsidiary to our meals. And I'll explain that. If you make a fancy dinner and you select the best bread, you go to a bakery, you know, we'll say you're having your boss over or, you know, something like that, you know, a higher status person, an in-law, and you do your best, you put this beautiful bread on the table, which of course shows that bread has some extra meaning for us, that we'll want to choose this sort of what we think of as the best. But if everyone doesn't eat it, if some of your guests don't eat it at all, you don't feel, oh my God, they didn't like the, you know, they didn't eat the casserole, they didn't like the meat, they didn't eat this. When you serve a dinner, if you've got a dinner party with 12 people, if half of them don't eat the bread, nothing. But if they leave a pile of rice peel off on the plate, you think, oh, gee, what's going on there? So that, I think that's one indication that bread is not important in our diet because it is an accessory to a meal, and we actually have no emotional investment in whether that accessory is even appreciated or not. You're asking about the bread laws.
Yeah, let's have a chat about those. Hang on, I'll stop. There we go. So I'm sitting here with one of the most renowned food historians in the world, William Riefel.
You're laughing going a little now. Too far, Vanessa. Okay,
no, I think
it's very kind of you. Thank you.
I think it's true. You're just being modest. You. You're a bread specialist, and I have your book here in front of me, Bread, the Global History. And there are just a few questions I wanted to ask you that are specific, really for my own personal interest. We've got a lot of the influence, I think, on the world has been bread and the laws that have surrounded it. And I know from my own reading that some of the bread laws go back as far as Egyptian and even Roman times. And I wondered if you could enlighten me to the bread laws that have gone on throughout history. It's something that, you know, I know you know a lot about.
Well, I know something about. So I'm writing a very big book on bread for the University of California Press. And I haven't gotten to some parts, all right? So this is what I can say. The switch from hunting-gathering to grain agriculture in the Levant, so in what is now southern Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Palestine, that shift began to take place about 12,000 years ago, with a sedentary culture called the Natufians, who were hunter-gatherers but were sedentary. They actually lived very much like the native people in California at the point of contact. They, in the Levant, they harvested grains, and it does seem that a lot of improvement to the grains, particularly the increase in grain size, took place before agriculture. Once they began farming, we see a big shift fairly quickly in, you know, historic times in terms of the size of communities. So if you take Jericho, for example, is one of the oldest cities that's been excavated. The hunter-gatherer layer in Jericho is small. It's just hundreds of meters in diameter. But the first layer, I haven't looked at this for a long time, is something like 2.6, I think, acres, not hectares. So I guess that's what half that in hectares. But it's just radically bigger. And you have stone walls. And you have irrigation channels. And you have a tower. And you've got, you've got stairs made out of stone that have been pointed. And you have skulls with plaster and cowrie shells. So you have a radical increase in material culture. And bread is what fed that. And bread fed the first big city, which was Uruk, which is the home of the king that we have the story from, the story of Gilgamesh. So bread fed these big Mesopotamian cultures. Bread built the pyramids. Bread built Greece and Rome. So there will have been bread laws that I haven't yet studied that we may know about. There are undoubtedly bread laws that we don't know about. We do know there were bread laws in the Roman period that regulated prices and distribution. The ones that I know the most about are the British ones, which is called the Assize for Bread. They're similar to bread laws that were throughout Europe, France, Italy, essentially every country.
So can you give me the start of the British bread laws?
The British bread laws was in the sometime in the 14th century, so in the latter part of the 1300s. And this was the first time that governments came in that we know of in a period that leads directly to us, to regulate prices to protect poor people. So clearly, before you had massive abilities to store grain, you had problems and when distribution systems weren't as advanced as they are now, you had problems of spiking grain prices when you had regional crop failures. I mean, even now we have spiking grain prices sometimes. But so what these laws were set out to do was to keep the baker from being able to profit on spikes in grain. So the baker had no incentive to hoard grain, for example, and then make bread and sell it at a really high price, and then make bread when the price is really high out of that grain that he had stored. And I will say, when I'm using he, most bakers were men, but there were female bakers, because the widows could take over from the businesses.
It's quite an interesting concept. From my point of view, I was looking at, you were talking 14th century. If I move on from there and look at something like the grain laws, they seem to me to be protecting the landowners, not the poor people.
Well, the assize for bread, the regulations that regulated the price of bread that was sold by bakeries, is the purpose was to protect poor people. In Europe, most of these laws ended in the 19th century. France still has a bread law. They have a baguette that you can always buy that is a price-regulated baguette. And I think it's 90 euro cents, or it might be 1 euro for a particular size bread. And that's under price control, and of course that's for poorer people. No, the way it worked was that the government thought of bakers modern terms as a regulated monopoly. You need the license to sell bread. Bread was a staple. Everybody needed it. A staple meaning that they got over half their calories from bread. Most people. Not elites, but most people. And so they had to have this product. Just as we have to have electricity, we have to have water. And until these until this whole sort of deregulation in Britain from since Margaret Thatcher, it was also understood that governments allowed you to produce electricity, but in exchange, a few people to produce electricity or one company, but in exchange, your profit was limited. So this is the same concept. So we give you the right, Vanessa, to sell bread in your village, but in exchange for the right, you had to accept certain limits on what you could make. And the price, the limits were simple. You were guaranteed a certain amount of money per volume or weight of grain that you made into bread. And it was sold by the quarter, which is like a certain number of bushels. Doesn't really matter. A unit called a quarter. It's roughly 480 pounds of grain. So for every 480 pounds, you got a certain amount of money.
This was also a way of taxing the people there, right?
It was not a way of taxing the people at all. It had nothing to do with the tax. This is a way of protecting the people. So
Okay, so it was the millers that were taxed, where the tax came in.
Well, and this has nothing to do with millers, because the baker, when you went, okay, and this will say is up until Queen Anne, George II, so up until the early part of the 18th century, the laws were the same. Bread was sold at a fixed price of 1 penny, half a penny, or a quarter of a penny, a farthing. And when the price of grain went up, the size of your loaf went down. And when the price of grain went down, the size of your loaf went up. Because when you went to the baker and you said, "Here is my penny," you were buying from the baker 1 penny's worth of grain at the market price. And this was of the number 2 grade grain. So if you're involved at all in agriculture, then you know that products are all graded. And your apples are graded, your pears are graded, your carrots are graded, and especially your grains are graded. So a number 1 grade wheat today weighs 60 pounds. One bushel of number 1 grade wheat weighs one bushel weighs 60 pounds. And this bushel is still used as a measure because the United States retains the bushel as a measure. We did not switch to metric, and we control the international grain trade because we're so big. This bushel is the Winchester bushel, which Britain used up until 1826 when you switched over to the imperial bushel, which is a slightly different size. But when you're reading bread history and you're reading the assize laws, it's based on the Winchester bushel for the last few hundred years. The number 1 grain weighed 60 pounds. They went to the market, literally, in each village, and said and looked at the number 2 grade, which was roughly less weight per bushel, and said, "How much is this?" And then made a table, and based on that table, derived the size of the loaf you were going to get for the different grades of flour. But everybody was buying, whether you wanted a whole grain bread or whether you wanted white bread, you were buying 1 cent worth or half a cent worth or a quarter cent worth of grain. And then that grain was milled. And if you wanted to get all of your penny's worth or all of your half penny, because you needed that, then they would make that into a whole grain loaf. In fact, they would sift out a small percentage of the bran, because most people didn't want branny bread. So a little bran goes out, and the baker got to keep that bran as part of his pay. And he could use that bran to make horse bread, which was also regulated, because horses eat bread and require bread if they're going to do continuous work. If you're going to take your horse with a load of stones or a load of something and go 20 miles with it, and the horse stops and you stop and you get your lunch, if you're just going to give the horse hay to eat, the horse will not have enough energy to keep going. So you fed the horse bread. And so that was also sold and regulated by the same laws that regulated the bread for people.
It's quite interesting that we would feed our horses our transport was fueled by the same stuff that we were fueled with. Quite an interesting symbiotic relationship there. That's I hadn't thought of that.
Well, one of the big differences between a dog, a domesticated dog, and a wolf is that dogs have the enzyme. Dogs are able to digest bread. So we fed our dogs bread until very recently. And in one sense, we still do. And we also still feed horses bread. But that's...
I didn't know that.
Well, if you go to equestrian website, if you go to the websites for high-performance horses, for race horses...
I was more interested in the dog, actually.
Okay. Yeah, one of the genetic differences between a dog and a wolf is that the dog can consume bread.
Can you send and if that? You stay, can you send me a link to it? Do you have any information on that? I'd be interested. Because I make sourdough dog biscuits.
Yeah, and they can eat it, but a wolf wouldn't be able to eat it.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and when you stay with poor people, you know, I've stayed with Romani families in Romania, then of course they're feeding their dogs bread.
Well, we feed the dogs bread in France. I mean, we stick it in a bowl, you get slops with it, the bread gets mashed up, and you throw in whatever hasn't been eaten. Beans, peas, gravy, you know, chicken bones. It just, you know, the dogs in the village when I grew up were, I mean, no one bought dog food.
So... Do you have questions about this? Was I mean, maybe too long-winded? Sort of clear? So if the price of grain went up, then what, your penny bought less grain, so you got a smaller loaf.
I think that's fast. I'd never understood that from reading the bread laws, that basically, you know, depending on the price of grain, your loaf went up and down. A penny loaf could be, you know, according to the size. That makes sense now. So, I mean, looking at... Just some sort of answer. Say the corn laws are something else I'm quite interested in. That the corn laws were really brought in. Who drove the corn law repeals?
I mean, to be honest, I'm not yet very familiar with the corn laws.
Okay.
So I think you have a British audience. A lot of your listeners are going to know a lot more about the corn laws than I do. I haven't studied the corn laws.
I tend to have a little look at it.
But I will say, I know a lot of people get confused. Corn simply means grain laws and does not refer to maize.
No, I know. That is something
And
that
people can... do get confused. So I think it's important to say.
It's quite important for that. Yeah. So one of the other questions I have, I read and came to the conclusion, I wonder what your opinion is of this. We... were controlled in the bakers by the weight of the loaf. And if you sold a loaf that was underweight, there were some quite serious consequences, weren't there?
Yes, but. A big focus of the literature on the assize laws is all about punishments for breads that are underweight. And I honestly feel I'm very skeptical. I don't think, yes, I'm simply skeptical. First of all, it's a narrative that detracts from actually understanding what the bread laws were really about. Second of all, yes, there are always people who cheat, so I'm sure there were some cheaters, just as we can take in the United States... this enormous energy company, Enron, that cheated on the electrical prices. And I remember we were having brownouts in California, and I live in California, and, you know, I'm actually politically very on the left, but I'm not a conspiracy person, and people were saying, oh, is this a conspiracy, and this, and I thought, how utterly ridiculous. But in fact, Enron was manipulating the market and cheating, and lots of people went to jail. The company doesn't exist. Of course there's cheaters. There also, in villages, are vendettas against people. I mean, we...
I'm moving to a point. My point is that culturally, we've been talking about culture, that as a baker, I know that if I underbake my loaf... and I don't quite drive off the moisture at the levels that it could be, say, for example, with this tartine loaf here, and I keep quite a white, light, easy crust, that I can keep as much as 10 or 15% of the water. So one of my through my reading and through what I have concluded, we've been talking about cultural acceptance of bread and what we expect. I would say that those laws have actually created a culture that enjoys a kind of white, not too baked bread in the UK as the mass market. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, my thought is, I don't agree with you. These bread laws ended a long time ago.
But culture can take, you know, decades and centuries to move.
No, there's nothing in the literature to suggest they were selling extra wet bread.
No, but white rather than this.
Well, let's get back to the wetness, because I can answer that.
Okay.
So
and
first of all,
profit-wise, it makes sense. I mean, you get an extra 10-15% profit.
So yeah, I haven't yet worked out exactly how there clearly was a cultural control over what constituted an acceptable commercial loaf. So first of all, they were selling grain, not selling water. So historically, bread was made with 50% water by weight of flour. For those of you familiar with the American bagel, that will be the consistency of a bagel recipe. Commercial bread recipes are given in terms of percentages of ingredients. So modern bread, if you take a very one with very big holes, you have to have a wet dough comparatively to get big holes. So the biggest hole bread in our panoply of breads is the ciabatta, which is typically 80% water by weight of flour, but some really advanced bakers and skilled bakers can do it at 1-to-1, 100% water, 100% flour. In other words, if you have 500 grams of water, you have 500 grams of flour, which is a batter, and miraculously they're able to turn that into a bread. What we have accepted is that we're willing to pay a lot for water, but historically, they were eating this. And remember, we went to the baker, we gave them our money, and we wanted grain to feed our bellies. So the 100 grams of bread in 1650 had more grain in it than the 100 grams of this tartine loaf that we've been looking at here. Because this one is made with, what, 70 or 75% water?
Maybe more like 83,
84. Okay, 83 or 84%. Okay, so this has fewer calories than the old loaf. Now, from the historic record, it is clear that the evaporation in the oven, the weight loss, was around 13%. And that's what we get today. And you can go bake bread, and when it's done, it's around 13%. So, yes, if you underbake it, then, and there'd be certainly a tendency, you would think, to underbake so that you don't risk being underweight. But, on the other hand, you also want clients to come to your bakery. Because remember, we're not talking about just necessarily, it wasn't one baker per village, you had more than, there was competition between bakers. So I think that the market will have directed people to the well-made loaf.
Okay.
And a gummy, you know, a gummy loaf just isn't very good.
Okay, cool. That's it's certainly an interesting perspective. William, we've been chatting about bread and the past of bread, where bread is at now. We've been talking about culture and cultural expectation.
We've not talked about bread is about now. We've talked about where one very small part of the bread world is now.
Okay. So where are we with bread now? What's the current, in a historian's point of view, where are we at?
Most bread that most of us eat is bread made in very large factories with integrated production systems, fully automated. And that's where bread is at now in most of the world that eats loaf breads. We need to specify, I mean, first of all, I mean, there's lots of kinds of breads in the world, and most of us humans eat flatbreads. Way more flatbread than loaf bread. So when we say bread and assume a loaf bread, we are itself really saying something about our own culture and our own cultural myopia. But within the loaf bread world, most of our bread we eat is industrially produced, and industrial in the sense of factories that are, you know, a block, you know, huge factories, fully integrated.
We've had a what people call, hang on, I just want to pull that right. We've had what people are calling a bread renaissance, or a revolution in bread, with these big kind of open crumb, dark, crusty, long, slow fermented bread. It's even to the point where the bakery that I've come to meet and see here is tartine. There are even adjectives describing bread as being tartinesque. At the same time in Britain, historically, loaves of industrially produced white bread are falling in favour of what could be called more artisanal bread. I don't want to define that. So can you just tell me from your point of view, this is a moment in history, isn't it? Are things changing? Because, I mean...
I'm writing a very big bread history, and history of bread is not the history of American bread or the history of British bread, or of French bread. So I find the construction itself very culturally determined.
Okay.
So yes, in the United States...
Well, I'm asking you questions about the market that I'm talking about is the British, Anglo-American, perhaps even Canadian, Australian, and maybe South African breads. That's what I'm talking about at the moment.
Okay, and I think what I said earlier is that we're in San Francisco, and San Francisco is the center of a cultural revolution that took place in the United States beginning in the late 1960s, and that was the hippie movement. And this movement that you see grows out of the hippie movement. And various of us, because I'm of that generation, we responded. I'm a little bit younger. I'm 64, and really it's people who are sort of 60, it is splitting hairs, but, you know, 68 to 75, you know. Because so I went to college in 1970, but it was a period when I didn't graduate from college. I had long hair and a beard. I only had one pair of pants, and I had an overcoat, and I went barefoot. And I am of that period. And one thing the hippies did is really change, ask questions about, our culture, our American culture, including the food that we eat. And we collectively rejected the breads of our ancestors. We rejected the breads of our parents, but also all kinds of other foods, you know. And at first it was rather crude. You know, the hippie breads are really an American bread, which is also an Anglo bread, which is to say yeast leavened. It has sweetener in it. Rather than sugar, they switched it to honey. They switched the flour from white to whole wheat. And they switched, you know, but it also included oil. And the exemplar of that would be the Tassajara Bread Book by Ed Wood. It's still a very influential book. And or you could look at Laurel's Kitchen. These are influential books from that period. But it was a whole reevaluation, not just of bread, but of living and eating and the relationship with the land. Then from San Francisco, you have people, especially Alice Waters and in the bread world. I think someone you're going to be speaking with, Steve Sullivan, who's from that period. They sort of moved sort of out from the hippie food, which was brown rice and not particularly refined, and were heavily influenced by French cuisine, but not in a simple way, but also in this relationship between the diner and the producer. So over time, the whole farmers market movement, or the restaurants that have contractual relationships with particular farmers, or that go to the farmers markets to buy their food, which is now very standard in California, and you also have it, I know, in London. This plus the bread is also it's all part of a reevaluation of who we are, the relationship we want to have with what we eat. And in picking up this rough French bread, this bread that Tartine makes is a style of bread that you see in most of the bakeries in Paris. But as an historian, we also have to step back and say, well, why are those the breads in the bakeries in Paris? Because the Parisians themselves, the French themselves, have made a cut on their own bread history. And they have simplified their own bread history. And they have created a mythology about their own bread history, which has, for example, cut out completely the pain de luxe, which were the yeasted breads, and the lightly enriched yeasted breads, the pain de Rennes, the pain de Ségovie, the pain cousin. I mean, there's so many breads from the 17th, 18th, and 19th century that are simply missing from the French bakery. The rye breads, the French were essentially rye bread eaters outside of Paris way, 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 way through the 19th century, almost to the 20th. And compared to the British, for example, that stopped eating rye bread in the 18th century. And they've made this whole cult of the sourdough, which you can find in the 18th century in France, even a bit earlier. But they have brought this, you know, now as their only bread history, and it's simply not there. But when Alice Waters and these young Americans discovered France in the early 1970s, late 1960s, and they discovered the bread and the good eating and the dining and the eating together, you know, they're rebelling also against the American meal that's standing up by the refrigerator, the family that everybody sort of eats themselves, the reductive ad absurdum, the TV dinner that's a frozen meal with an aluminum tray with a space for the vegetables, a space for the meat, a space for the dessert. And they're seeing this conviviality and breaking bread. Of course, you can't break a bread of pre-sliced, you know, bread.
Sorry.
You know, bread.
I have to get you to say that again. Oh no. Sorry. Say that last bit again. You can't. I just stop laughing now. Because
okay.
It's just
okay.
This idea of breaking, like, sliced white, breaking sliced white, it just doesn't have quite the same romance, does it?
Well, it doesn't work.
Just say that?
So also culturally, they were looking at the whole way that we relate to each other, Americans relate to each other, over food. And you can't break a pre-sliced bread, you can't break a loaf of already packaged bread, whereas you can break a loaf of this country style French bread. And then also we have this sort of this Luddite aspect, this anti-industrial and a critique of industrialism, which has grown into a fairly sophisticated critique of the industrial food system. But it is imagined, and it's absolutely not true, that this kind of bread that is made by Tartine that you see in the French bakeries cannot be made by robots. That it has to be touched by a baker. So we have brought in with this bread the fantasy, which was certainly true at the very beginning, that you've got a small baker in a neighborhood bakery who is making this loaf of bread, forming it by hand. In other words, not dropping it into an industrial-made rectangular loaf, that everything about it is touched by a person. Now, I invite you to go onto YouTube and type in, you know, bread robots and Japanese bread robots especially, and German ones. And you, what you're going to see is going to blow your mind, because there are these magnificent machines that form these loaves by allowing a ball which has been, formed by you've got a big bunch of dough, and you need to break it up into the right sized pieces, the 500 gram piece of dough, actually a little bit bigger, so when it shrinks in the oven, it finishes out at 500 grams when you buy it. And then there's a machine that does that. And many artisan, any big artisan baker uses it. Nobody is sitting there with, you know, 1,000 kilos of bread dough and sitting there by hand. I'm getting aphasia for what's it called. What is it called when you break it up into the right size pieces?
I'm just cutting it.
No, but it isn't. There's another word for it.
Gliding?
Anyway, it doesn't matter. So it's a machine that will do that. But then it's called rounding. Then there's a machine called a rounder. And the rounder is this incredibly beautiful spiral. It's like a, if you have a child and been to a playground with modern slides, it's a slide that you, it's a corkscrew. And the bread just moves down this corkscrew. I mean, so gentle, just perfectly gentle. There's no hands that could be as gentle with it. And I don't know exactly, oh yes, an artisan. So it is now possible to make breads in factories with modern equipment that is really the same as what comes out of an artisan bakery, with the exception that they'll all look identical because they're made by computer. Unless you were to program in some random default, you know, fault generator. Bread is a time and temperature process. What's missing from your domestic cookbooks, always, with rare exceptions, what's missing is the timing and the temperature. So a commercial bread recipe doesn't say, you know, add some, you know, take this much water and put in this much flour and mix it and let it sit and then come back. It says that you want the dough temperature to be 25 degrees Celsius, and you have it sit for 1 hour and 43 minutes. And then you're going to do something else to it. It's all very...
Sorry, can you say that again? And then?
And then you're going to do something to it. And it's going to sit for another exact period of time, more or less, that's temperature controlled, even temperature and humidity controlled. So bread is time and temperature. It's the only way that a commercial bakery can turn out bread that is the same every day, every day, every day.
So is this the future of bread? Is this the future of artisan bread?
Okay, first of all, it is the bread of today. All bread. Virtually all bread in the world.
Ah, brilliant. This is the person I wanted you to meet.
If you enjoyed listening to that podcast as much as I enjoyed chatting with my guests, then you might like to find out a little bit more about what I do. Well, I teach courses both online and in person at thesourdoughschool.com. I also write regularly for sourdough.co.uk, and I have a couple of Instagram accounts that you might like to follow: Sourdough School, Sourdough Club. Oh, and I have a personal one, Vanessa Kimball. I really do love to hear people's thoughts and feedback about, well, the books I write, the podcast, the features, or if you have any questions, don't hesitate to get in touch. Thank you for listening.